LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and the first thing for today is to apologise for the less than ideal sound quality of my first few questions to my guest, who is Paul Devereaux, who joins us to discuss his book Stone Age Soundtracks, The Acoustic Archaeology of Ancient Sites. Until recently, almost all archaeological insights have been gleaned by looking at ancient remains. Now archaeologists are starting to think beyond the visual. One of the most exciting branches of the new multisensory archaeology is archaeoacoustics, the archaeology of sound. Ancient civilizations developed far more than fine artwork and magnificent monuments. In songs to their gods, laments for their dead, and the universal human quest for the supernatural, people also made some very strange noises. Boulders and stalactites incised with prehistoric rock art that ring like bells and gongs. A Bronze Age stone drum alongside a rushing lake that can be heard for miles when struck. Ancient rock paintings and petroglyphs that have secret soundtracks. Mayan ruins that emit echoes mimicking the call of sacred birds. Mysterious temples and tombs possessing eerie acoustic effects. Amazonian shamans who use subtle sounds to guide people through drug-induced visionary states. Stone Age musical instruments and megalithic sites that seem to move when subjected to certain sounds. All this and much more is explored in Stone Age Soundtracks. Without acoustics, archaeology is deaf. And in looking back to hear the old stones speak, maybe we can learn how to move forward. Hello and welcome, Paul, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Happy to be here, Greg.
Today, Paul, we're going to be discussing some of the themes that in your book, Stone Age Soundtracks, The Acoustic Archaeology of Ancient Sites. This is a book that came out quite a few years ago. And of course, developments have continued in this area at pace, and we'll get to that later on. Before we dive into all that, tell listeners just a little bit about your background and your work in general, and then also how you became interested in this area. What is it that really gripped you about what's known as archaeoacoustics?
Well, I first got interested. I was a painter. I'm trained as a painter, and I became interested in a long while ago, back in the 60s, in the whole ley line thing and so on. So I started getting magazines on that and getting interested. It took a couple of years, because I'm a slow learner, that a lot of it was rubbish. But as I went into it, I really got involved. I used ancient sites, their ground plans and so on, as part of inspiration for my paintings. And I sort of slid into archaeology in that way. And in the end, the New Age nonsense, which still proliferates on the internet, unfortunately, about earth mysteries and so on, began to suffocate me. And what I do now is I'm a co-founding managing editor of a journal called Time and Mind, a journal of archaeology, consciousness and culture, which is sort of grown up earth mysteries. It's it's properly peer reviewed and so on, but using some of the most forward thinking people in the field. And so as part of that process, or about 15 or more years ago, I became aware that people were doing research into sound at ancient sites, archaeological sites. And most of this was like studying the acoustics of Roman and Greek amphitheatres and that sort of thing. But that intrigued me. And the more I went into it, the more I wanted to know. And then in 2003, I'd written a few things about sound and archaeology. And in 2003, in Cambridge University, a symposium was held by people who were interested in doing work in archaeoacoustics. And I was invited to that. It was a sort of closed symposium, more or less. And I saw the breadth of work that was going on, how people were looking at the echoes from rock art in caves and rock shelters and so on, and how people were monitoring where rock art might appear in a Paleolithic cave and how strong the echoes and sound reflections would be. And I particularly got interested in work that was going on looking at stalactites and stalagmites in Paleolithic caves, because some of these, if you tap them, will produce ringing noises or harp-like sounds or bell-like sounds. And some of them showed evidence of having been struck lightly tens of thousands of years ago. You'd see the marks covered over with calcite deposits. And so this intrigued me, and so I've got more and more into it. And then there's a group called International Consciousness Research Laboratories. Then at that time, in the early mid-90s, was based in Princeton University, and I was involved with that, mainly from a consciousness studies point of view. One of the projects we did there was to look at sound in ancient places. We looked at some Anasazi, American Indian stuff in the American Southwest. And then we moved it to Britain and Ireland to look at how would sound behave inside some of the chambers in the Neolithic passage graves and so on. And we did that. We got some interesting results. A very important paper was produced from that. One of the things we found was a recurring focus resonance, a fundamental resonance of 110 hertz, which is the lower register of the human voice, and a baritone. And one of the members of the group is a clinical neuroscientist, and he conducted an experiment which showed that if people were exposed to this sound frequency, 110 hertz, uniquely, he tested a whole range of different frequencies, but at that frequency there were important regional changes in the brain of subjects, so that left and right hemispheres of the frontal cortex switched roles. One went quiet and the other was brought up more alive and so on. So this intrigued us. And so I've got on, and my particular specialism within, at the 2003 symposium, the actual term archaeoacoustics was coined. by Professor Chris Scar. He said that this, at the moment, it's a loose assemblage of people looking at sound. He said we need an overall umbrella term, and that was the term they came up with, rather along the lines of archaeoastronomy 20-odd years earlier. And in a way, archaeoacoustics is like the early years of archaeoastronomy. And we, and so it's developed. My particular specialism within archaeoacoustics is the study of rocks that make metallic or musical sounds. And we've been doing quite a lot of work in that area.
Okay, well, some of those points that you touched upon there, we'll come back to in a little bit more detail. One thing to consider here, which perhaps, you know, a casual observer wouldn't think of, but it's very important, and this would have applied several hundred years ago, but particularly when we're looking at thousands of years ago, the Earth was much, much quieter. This is very, very important, because today we live in an environment where silence is at a premium, if not virtually impossible to find, for millions of people anyway. And this idea that the Earth was much, much quieter, not least because there were less people, but also because they didn't have our lifestyles, our technology, our media, and all the other things that come with it. So it's just a really important background, I think, to all of this.
Well, that is exactly right. And as of course you will know, even if you're on a remote hillside somewhere and you want to record something, and it seems to be nice and quiet, and you're in the bosom of nature, when you start recording, you realize there's a distant sound of a plane somewhere or some other errant sound getting in on the recording. And you're quite right. We live in a noisy world, and silence is truly golden these days.
Now, another interesting aspect of this is understanding that, if you shall loosely refer to them as the ancients, just for the want of a better term, they may not, would have lacked our scientific understanding of sound, how it works, how it's generated. And this would have altered their perception of things that perhaps sound-wise we take for granted, like natural sounds and how they're affected in natural sites that have got special sonic properties that, again, we perhaps now have managed to work out what's going on there. And, of course, their consciousness really was different, so they would have interpreted sounds differently. For example, the idea that you mentioned that the caves and the sonic properties in there, the idea that echoes could perhaps be interpreted as spirits. And if there were sounds emanating from, you know, the natural world, but they were disembodied, you know, there was no obvious source for them, then that again perhaps would have been interpreted differently to how we might do so.
Absolutely, yeah. One of the problems of modern archaeology has been, it's less so now, but it has been, the fact that we forgot that ancient people had ears. And we are a very visual culture here in the 21st century in the West. And so everything was really to do what we could see, what we could dig up. It was a breakthrough in the 1970s when archaeologists started looking around. They'd been studying sites as if they had a frame around them. And then suddenly some archaeologists started looking, how does this stone circle relate to that hillside or to that other stone circle half a mile away, and so on. And slowly a regional approach to the perception occurred. But still it was visually based, which is fine. But the sound has followed on very much as a Cinderella subject later. But we are now beginning to use our ears to try to understand what ancient people heard. And I got to tell you, it's quite a powerful thing if you, let's say, strike a stone that's got all the marks of prehistory on it, where people struck that stone before, hundreds, thousands of years ago, and you hear the sound that they would have heard. And yes, as you summarized quite correctly, their understanding of sound is not ours. We know that sound is travels through a medium like air or whatever. It reflects off surfaces and so on, often a tremendous problem when people are designing theatres and music halls and so on. And we understand it's a physical thing. It's a pressure wave in the air. It's a physical thing. But to earlier people, sound did have a magical quality. I'm not saying there weren't people in some of those early societies who figured it out, but certainly at a cultural level, it was, the sound was could be magical. And it can be. I've been inside the chamber at New Grange in Ireland, for example, and if you set a sound generator in the middle of that chamber and you set it to that resonant, the fundamental resonant frequency of that chamber, the sound wave goes out from the loudspeaker, hits the walls and comes back and produces a standing wave. And you can walk out from the center to the walls of that chamber, and at certain points the sound gets really loud because you're at the peak of the wave, and then a couple of feet further in and you're down in the trough of the wave and it goes quiet, and then another couple of feet and it's loud again, and so on. It's a very strange behavioral thing, and it was interpreted usually as spirits. Echoes were often the voices of spirits living behind a cliff face or the surface of a rock or whatever. So it was magical. Two van throat singing, for example. Now it's done on stage. It's a performance thing, but its origins were to communicate with the spirits of a place. And the old two van throat singer masters could go to a point in a cave, and they'd go to the exact spot. They'd learn exactly where the point was. The temperature had to be right. They were the master technicians of the echo. And then they would make their sounds and get the maximum reflective echo properties. And this would be the place responding to them. And it was understood in a completely different way to the way we look at sound now.
Yes, you did quite a bit of field work. You mentioned New Grange, you visited other sites. And the section in your book, which deals with, for example, the experiments at New Grange, is really brought to life in the Associated TV program, which is part of the Secrets of the Dead series, which I believe came out around about the same time. The idea that, we're looking at peoples that were using these spaces for, well, in many cases only guests, but, ceremonial purposes, sacred purposes, ritual purposes. And it's mind-blowing, actually, when you look at the TV documentary interpretation of this, when you put it all together, the sound, the atmosphere, I mean, we've talked, the incense, you get people together in a group, the energy changes in any event, and you get the special time of year at a solstice or whatever, and you have light and sound all coming together. And the first thing I thought of was there was a quote in the program, and I'm paraphrasing now, but someone using the expression Stone Age priests using sound and light in a spectacular display of their power. And I thought, well, what is that? I did an interview in my role as a music journalist with a band a couple of years ago, and the lead singer was saying, this is modern shamanism. And I thought, this is a rock concert, sound and light and a spectacular display of power, depending on the nature of the music, of course. But this particular guy I was talking to was very interested in the transcendent quality that music can still have. And certainly I watched this particular band. If people are interested, actually, the band's called Fields of the Nephilim. And I've mentioned this in interviews before. And when the zenith of their music was reached, I felt like I was being lifted off the ground. And the fact that this could still happen, I think that, yes, we have lost a lot of understanding and lost a lot of appreciation of what the ancients might have experienced in terms of sound. And their consciousness was different. But those fundamental, primordial connections with sound, I think, are still there. It's just been lost somehow along the way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, music can have profound physiological and mental and spiritual effects. There's no two ways about it. I think probably everybody who's listening to this will have had examples of that in their own lives. Yes, these people were using, I mean, the old megalith builders, if you like. They liked to put on a light and sound show. They were displaying. Generating spectacle, if you like. And there's been studies done now at Stonehenge in places where we've been able to map the way sound behaves. And you can more or less map where an officiant would have stood to have intoned a prayer or played an instrument or whatever for maximum effect. And also places where the sound is attenuated, where it disappears. There's no doubt they were ceremonialists, and it is basically the same human response, as you're saying now, to certain music. Shamanism, of course, definitely did use music. Even ayahuasqueros in the Amazon use sound, sort of a shushing sound of a particular type of rattle, or they may start humming and singing with somebody who's deep and in trance. And the sound, people have described how the sound can carry them along, literally out of their bodies. In fact, funnily enough, there's a study of West Kennet Long Barrow near Avebury in the current issue of Time and Mind, where the guy who doing the measurements found profound effects in certain of the chambers under certain frequencies that did seem to generate an out-of-body experience. So, sound is powerful, and it's always been known to be powerful, and it's been used down the ages of humanity. And I think what we now call archaeoacoustics, if you like, is the backbeat to our musical history.
Well, you mentioned ayahuasca a moment ago. I mean, when you factor in hallucinogens or other ways that people's consciousness could have been altered, for example, there was a section again about, you mentioned the cave art, about the, was it magnesium oxide, the compound that they were using to paint the rock art. But yeah. Even that way, getting basically poisoned, but it would affect their consciousness, and particularly, as I say, with hallucinogens, all your senses are heightened, and they all start to kind of cross over and blend. I find, like, in a sort of, you can smell the colours and hear the lights type thing.
Synesthesia, yes.
Yeah, yes.
And there is a school of thought that thinks some of the rock art is synesthetic visions produced by sound and other things of people in trance. And we know, I wrote a book, The Long Trip, in which I present a lot of evidence for the use of psychedelics or entheogens or drugs, hallucinogens. Throughout human history, we've always been taking drugs, and particularly in the Americas, for example, there was tremendous use of mind-altering substances, tremendous use, really fundamental to many of the cultures there, the ancient cultures. And you could imagine you're producing sound, or there's a sudden shaft of light at midsummer, or whatever it might be, and that will trigger a synesthetic experience. As well as out-of-body experiences and all the rest. So it all has to be taken together. And to be quite honest with you, if you were living in prehistory, and prehistory is a different date at different parts of the world and different cultures, life could be pretty rugged and pretty tough. And so these celebrations, these magical acts, the acts of the shaman and so on, were tremendous breaks from that dreary round into a magical world. And it would be unquestionably manipulated to produce effects. Of course, from the shaman, you got the chieftain, and from the chieftain, you got the monarchs and so on. As these experiences became more and more encased as power symbols and societies became more stratified, more hierarchical, but at the base level, it's sound, it's light, it's smell, it's sensory experience in the service of spiritual activity.
And I suppose then a relatively modern example would be, I don't know, 70s or something, guy working in a bank, completely fed up, but it's a job, comes home and smokes a joint and listens to a Pink Floyd album and has the, you know, has the experience of like not being in that place for a while. You know, it's like, we have the same need for it, for escape.
The soul always needs to escape.
There's lots of evidence that even animals seek out altered states of consciousness, whether it's, you know, apes effectively brewing their own alcohol using fruit or other animals.
In Nordic countries, for example, reindeers have a special liking for Amanita muscaria, the fairy toadstool, the red-capped, white-spotted mushroom, and they really like that, and there's a lot of stone reindeer around in
yes,
parts of the north.
But we another connection I find we have, I was speaking earlier about the fact that we inherently have these same urges, these same responses. I mean, look at how some people respond to the sound of thunder or rain, wind and running water. You know, many of us just really like those sounds. It's a connection.
And you can have this experience yourself if you're reclining in a relaxed state with your eyes closed near a waterfall. And you hear that roar, which is basically a pink noise sound, and you start to hear voices in the sound. They emerge, and that's why a lot of waterfalls are sacred to early and primary peoples, because they are the abode of spirits. I mean, I've had experience myself once when I was heavily stoned. In a little cottage, and pouring rain outside, lashing at the windows. And that sound gradually turned into the beautiful, angelic sounds of a choir. And it became beautiful voices. And so this is when the sound and vision can morph into more complex things if you've got a sufficiently fluid state of consciousness.
Well, I have a little website marked up on my favorites on my computer. I think it's just called Natural Sounds. And you've got a selection of these sounds that I mentioned. And then you've got a little mixer, like a little multi-track mixer. And you can say select some rain and have that at 50%. And then put in some thunder at 20%. And maybe put in some running water or bird song or sounds of the forest and all this. And it's a way of kind of, well, I'm sat here in the middle of a city, you know, but I can do this and put on my headphones and suddenly I'm not, you know.
But it's the soul trying to escape, Greg. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, there are birds in the city and there is some running water and there certainly is wind and rain, but...
Well, going back to your earlier point about our noisy environment today, I mean, there's evidence now that a bird song in cities has increased in volume. The birds have had to cheep a lot louder than they used to do because of the ambient background sound.
Well, they're communicating, aren't they? They're not just doing it for our benefit. So,
doing it for their benefit.
Yes, yeah. There was in the Stonehenge segment, and I'm not sure this applies to all sorts of ancient sites, there was some exploration as to, again, the sound properties determining the design or the design, determining sound properties. And this will apply, as I say, at many other sites. And it's something, as you mentioned earlier, until relatively recently, wouldn't have been considered by many people. And, it looks like Stonehenge, for example, was actually altered as time went on, just to kind of hone the properties and just get it right. In the same way that, as you mentioned, if you're building a music hall or other similar venue, you get your sound guys in and they might put up damping and reflective panels and things. And maybe they might say, okay, we're going to have to take a couple of those out, put a couple of other ones in just to get it quite right. And then there's also the idea. And I know this is, exotic and a lot of people dismiss it outright, but I've certainly read people speculating about the possibility of sound being used to move or manipulate, stones in ancient sites. And I'm just throwing it out there because I love the idea. Because, you know, we're still trying to figure out, you know, how the hell did they move these blocks, sometimes hundreds of tons?
They move them by human sweat, toil, blood and tears. As we try to understand these things a bit more, we find there were techniques of moving stone, like the stone heads on Easter Island. Experiments were conducted using wooden rollers, for example, to pull one of these stones. And it was really hard going. And then one day somebody found that if they used green wood, with still moist with moss on it, they just slid away beautifully, dead easily. So there's all sorts of ways. There's no problem really at Stonehenge. You can build earthen ramps to raise things up. You can use various lever and pulley systems. I know it sounds terribly mundane, but these guys were engineers and they could do it. I mean, it's very hard to find somebody who could make you a spoked wheel nowadays. Techniques and skills rise and fall as technology changes in a culture over the ages. Of course, things are much more rapid now. Most people of a certain age have a real problem with computers and things, whereas the kids come in and they can take to it straight away. As for sound, levitating, I mean, it's been an old thing from the 60s that has, well, actually from the 1930s, this is suggested. And I was a full believer in it, but in the end, any evidence that's been put forward for it turns out to be phony, to be false. And you can move things with sound, because sound, as I say, is a physical force. But the idea of moving, you know, 20-ton blocks of rock around, hovering them in the air and placing them, it never happened.
Yeah, okay. I just threw it out there because it's interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Nothing
yeah.
else. But oh, no, I've got...
It's part of the lingua franca of New Age Earth mysteries, and it's always out there. So you do have to mention it.
I've got a friend who works in the heritage skills arena, and one of the things she spent a lot of time over many years doing is trying to encourage young people to learn, you know, to be ironmongers and coopers and things like that. Mm-hmm. And because we have major problems going forward with traditional skills like that, but that's another issue, I suppose, for another conversation. But one thing I considered, and this is touched upon with the infrasound section, is the relatively narrow frequency band of human hearing.
Yes.
The fascinating thing that came up in some of these sites and some of the research was you're experiencing sound, or human beings at this in these ancient sites could have experienced sound that they didn't hear, but they felt it.
Yeah.
And this is, again, it's actually a very important part of the overall experience, because everybody knows if you're at a rock concert, if you're there and the volume gets over a certain point, you know, you actually start to feel it. You know, you feel your parts of your body vibrate. And I've certainly been to events like that before where there was something happening at a certain frequency and I felt it in the center of my chest, and it actually got to be quite unpleasant after a while.
Yeah. Well, it can also happen at big outdoor firework displays. You know, you see them on TV and they're beautiful, you know, but that's being just being visual. You're divorced physically from the event. When you're there, you can feel the impact of some of these explosions of the fireworks. That you'll feel them in your body, and you can smell the cordite and everything. So again, it's the sensory impact. And definitely, yes, infrasound. I mean, who was it? I do write about this, but I can't remember everything I've written. One chap was doing anthropology in Papua New Guinea, I think, and with these people, and they bring out the men's secret society would bring out otherwise hidden and mysterious musical instruments. Could be like long 20-foot long bamboo hollow poles. Excuse me. And various other things, and they would produce this weird sound, the anthropologist said, And he realized they did this when there was distant thunderstorms. You couldn't hear the thunder. You could see the flashes of light on the horizon. He said, but what he realized was there was the thunder was producing infrasonic waves that were passing through the area of the tribe. And the tribal instruments augmented that infrasonic effect. You could hear the sound, but it went down, down, down into the infrasonic range. And he said it was the most eerie, mysterious, powerful feeling. So without knowing the mechanics of sound in the way that we do today, these people knew how to manipulate things. And another thing, for example, wind can have an effect on some of the passage graves. You know, if you blow across the top of a bottle, you get that tone, Helmholtz frequency. And you can get that inside of Neolithic passage grave chambered monuments. Sometimes that will degenerate, if you like, or go down into the infrasound range inside, and has powerful effects.
Just to give an example in the utterly, utterly mundane world, I remember living by the coast many years ago, and sometimes it would get very windy, wind coming up off the sea. We were only a few hundred yards from the sea. And if you left the garage door open and you were then in the kitchen, and it was a very windy day, it was this almost unbearably eerie, spooky sound, like some kind of disembodied female voice. And this was just the wind making its way through the garage and out into the garden, you know. So again, that doesn't, you can only imagine, okay, I was just going, it's the wind, I'll go and close the door. How might that have come across 5,000, 7,000 years ago?
Cultural context, yeah. It was the spirits calling to you, Greg.
Spirit.
Close the door, will you?
Spirits of the ocean, yes. You mentioned earlier ringing rocks and some of the Stonehenge blue stones you mentioned. We're just going to cut now to a sound sample of that, and we'll take this up straight afterwards.
You don't expect rock hit with another little tiny hand rock in your hand to make sounds like that. But we've done an amazing, with my colleague John Wozencroft at the Royal College of Art, we did many studies of that landscape in South Wales and Preseli. And we've studied some of the particular outcrops where sort of lithographic, whatever, chemical fingerprinting's got on that can locate those at the sources of certain stones now standing at Stonehenge. And we did detailed studied thousands of rocks in a controlled manner. And there's a very high percentage of ringing or musical rocks or lithophones, to use the term, up on that ridge and amongst those outcrops. It's a soundscape. And so the blue stones were brought from a soundscape to Stonehenge. And people say, well, you know, why would they bother to bring all those rocks all that way away with all the difficulties involved that would have been carting them all that way? Why would bother? And we think, those of us who did this work, we feel that one of the things, at least, was the magic, the mana in that soundscape, the idea that the spirits spoke out of the rocks, the sound themselves, the sonic effects. And so we've done this study, and we've made lots and lots of recordings. We've even had a professional percussionist up there, Zev, who has produced long tracks, just literally rock music, playing the rocks. And it's pretty dramatic stuff. And it's not isolated. It's not accidental, because across the ancient world, we know that rocks that made sounds were accorded special veneration, were viewed with significance. In ancient China, There was the practice of Bainshi, which means resonant rocks. And any rock that they saw rocks as the condensations of chi, the life force. And a rock that was unusually shaped would be particularly well endowed with chi. But a rock that produced sound was the most powerful of all. And even poets wrote poems about bringing rocks, rocks that rang like jasper and so on. And in the Americas, done quite a bit of work in the Americas, you can find rocks that have got percussion marks all over them that ring. And they were used usually, as far as we can find out, in rituals to do with coming of age and that sort of thing. In India, rocks, there are rock outcrops just like the rocks on Khan Menen, and that have rock art on them and that also ring, and that are Neolithic, so you're talking 2000-ish or more BC. By 700 AD, the Indians were putting ringing rocks, musical rocks, into their temples, and were very sophisticated, and perhaps would take a single rock, ringing rock, and carve columns into it, and each column would give a different note. And a lot of the basic notes of Indian classical music can be found in these rocks. So it truly is a backbeat to that music. And it's dramatic all over. In Africa, lots and lots of examples of lithobones of ringing rocks. And you find them in Britain too, for example. Year or two ago, I was up on the Scottish island of Tiree, and there's a rock there. It's alien geology. They think it was brought there by the ice fields and the ice age. And it's covered in over 50 hollows, cut marks from percussion. And it rings beautifully. I've got a recording of that as well. Everybody knows it was somehow used in a ritual that we don't know how, but somehow the people who lived on that island 1,000, 2,000 or more years ago knew that this rock was different and made sounds, and it was clearly the center of ritual activity. So these sort of, in Norway there are ringing rocks that were used, so the folklore says, to frighten away spirits, the sounds they made. And up on Khan Menen, on Preseli, there's a rock, for example, that's got these hollows in it. And if you hit that rock, it rings. And in fact, you can ring it a bit like a sort of cell phone jingle. But we know that they used the rocks and they did produce sound from them. But it would have been magical sound. And also there, there's a lot of magic mushrooms growing. So the chances are they would be used in ritual in altered states of consciousness, quite possible. And they would even see the spirits moving, if you like. So this is one aspect of the stones at Stonehenge, blue stones, that we think has been overlooked.
Okay, well, you've got me intrigued with this talk of actual rock music, so we've got a clip here. Well, I'm sure people will agree that was quite extraordinary, and I hope in some small way helped to evoke some of the atmospheres that you were discussing a moment ago. One thing that I have sort of an almost daily experience of, I know you mention Gothic cathedrals, in your book. Just to remind listeners, it's called Stone Age Soundtracks. And I work in one, and it's clear from being in that space that even, you know, 1,000 years, maybe even this is a Gothic cathedral, but maybe even in the Norman cathedrals as well, that sound was very important because, of course, lacking PA systems at the very minimum, they had to find a way to project sound around the space. And I'm told, but I haven't tested this out yet, that the chapter house here at York Minster, that you can stand at one side of it, and if someone's on the opposite wall whispering, you can actually hear them because of the nature of the space. And in terms of standing waves, I asked one of the guides about this, and I said, is this space higher than it is wider? Because I was wondering, depending on the frequency, could they even get one standing wave in there, one complete one? So I'm going to have to go and check that out. So this, if we're talking 1,000 years ago, or even as recently as 1,200, that was a very different sound world to the one we have, not just in terms of sound pollution, but in terms of how important sound was to people. I think amplification has just changed so much for us.
That's right. They say, you know, St. Paul's Cathedral has a whispering gallery, and you can get the same effect in some of the Mayan structures in the Yucatan. And we've also experienced it in Greece at Mycenae. There's a grave there, Tholos grave, so-called because it has a bee shape, like a hive shape. And that has a whispering gallery type effect. Sounds like buzzing bees. And bees in Greek folklore were the messengers of the dead, of the spirits of the dead. So there's probably sound symbolism. There's the famous case in Chichen Itza of the Castillo. It's a sort of stepped pyramid with a temple at the top. And a percussive sound made in certain places near its base will produce this picket fence sound echo with a chirp at the end. And the chirp is very, very similar acoustically to the primary call of the Quetzal bird, which was a sacred bird to the Mayans and the Aztecs. So there's definitely a whole area of sonic symbolism in the past still to be properly researched, worked out. As far as your Gothic cathedrals go, yes. I mean, I don't know whether this is true, but I've certainly read that some people consider that Gregorian plain chant was devised to maximize the echo enhance effect inside cathedral space. And that might or might not be true. I don't know. But certainly nobody is ever going to miss the acoustic properties of a cathedral. The builders would have known that too.
Oh, we have kids, young kids sometimes that come in with their parents to the cathedral. And when they discover what happens to their voices when they're in that space, they just start yelling their heads off. They love it.
Absolutely.
Their parents are trying to shut up, you know.
There's a chap called Igor Reznikov in France who's got a beautiful voice, and he's used his voice to explore Romanesque cathedrals. He's actually got a CD, whose name escapes me, with his singing inside of these cathedrals, using a fantastic place for sonic echo effects is the Hypogeum on Malta, the Halsaflini Hypogeum, which is Neolithic, and it's three floors carved out of the rock, three floors down under the ground, and we've done some work there as well. And the sound levels, the echoes go on and on and on. It's very eerie, very strange. And there's one chamber there called nicknamed the Oracle Chamber, because there's a niche in the wall And this particularly amplifies and resonates a human voice. And I did a little bit of work there looking at, and he's got Neolithic painting on the ceiling of apparently a plant, all its fronds reaching down. And everything stops dead at this niche, and the fruit, all these round shapes in these curvilinear lines, get bigger and bigger and bigger until you get to the niche. And then inside the niche, there are three of these circular discs. And I'm pretty sure that's a visual recording, a visual depiction of the amplification effect. And it would have been understood in a completely different context to the way we understand sound today.
I've just suddenly remembered, are we talking about ringing rocks that... And again, I'm not necessarily expecting you to respond to this as such, but I read something a few years ago, and I don't know when this happened, but some object or other that NASA were monitoring struck the moon, and NASA reported that the moon rang like a bell, and they did not expect this at all. And people started speculating, oh, is the moon hollow? But that's by the by. But I believe you can find information about this online, but it's just another intriguing little nugget of information that I thought of.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that too. We haven't carried our research to the moon yet.
Well, you know,
somebody will build me a rocket.
I think Richard Branson's working on it, isn't he? So,
he is. Yeah.
No, just really to pick up an early point I made, we're talking about how quiet the world would have been in millennia gone by. We have now, through, I don't know whether it would have been starting, I guess the Industrial Revolution played quite a big part in it, you know, getting loud environments in cities and a lot of people moving from the country into cities. But where we find ourselves now, I certainly seek out silence. It's very important, I think, to have some of that time. But a lot of people I notice have a profound discomfort with silence. You know, they live in this constant cacophony. Yes. And there's other pollution of the senses, like light pollution. I mean, where can you actually go to get darkness now? So you just have to lie down in bed and put those little blindfolds on that you get on airplanes. But this, you see it in people in social situations. You know, people will be sitting in a dentist's waiting room and they've got to have a TV on the wall now or have the radio on because people can't sit still in silence when actually it's an extremely valuable thing. So I think I'm not quite sure what it's down to, really. It's a psychological thing, perhaps.
Well, I think people are more stressed by the ambient sound of the modern world than they perhaps realize. It's definitely stress-inducing. And to get some peace and quiet, it is rare. It's a gift. That's why you get these sound-canceling headphones, of course. But we live in a noisy world. My colleague John Rosencroft has a phrase. He said, these days we guzzle sound. And it's what we do. We're noisy, boisterous, pollution-producing species. Our culture is based on waste, and it's the sound is just everywhere. As I said, you know, even when you think you're out in the country, especially if you make a recording, you'll suddenly realize the background sounds that your mind had cancelled out, because it has to do that as a sort of reflex action to the noise in the world. And you're quite right, of course, in prehistory especially, it would have been quieter. So sound took on far more importance. And also different cultures. I remember, was it Alfred Gill, I think, the anthropologist? He was studying many years ago when he was a young man. He was studying a tribe in Papua New Guinea. And later he realized that he was trying to see things. And he said, I never saw a complete village because of the trees and whatnot. And one day some bloke came running in terrified, one of the tribal people, saying he'd encountered this spirit on the track leading into the village. And so Gil said, well, what did he look like? And he went, Yeah, but what did it look like? Oh, he said, he went, and it took him a while. And looking back, he said, I'd like to go and do that field work again. Because I was trying to understand that cult, tribal culture in terms of vision. He said, but I now realize their primary sense was sound. And their second sense was smell. And visual was only their third sense because of the nature, the dense nature of the jungle environment in which they live. And so not every culture has been so visually dominant as we are. And sound could be much more important.
Since Stone Age Soundtracks was published, how have things developed with archaeoacoustics? You know, what are some of the key things that have emerged?
Oh, well, as I say, it was, I think, I'm pretty sure, certainly in the English language, Stone Age Soundtracks was the first whole book on the subject. And we've come on a lot and we've been mentioning some of it. A better understanding now of lithophones and their role in the world cross-culturally. There's a lot of work done on the acoustics of chambered spaces. It's just a question of ongoing research. More, it's getting people and equipment out to sites. We've done most things on a shoestring budget. Fortunately, the Royal College of Art backed us for a lot of our work. But unless you get that, and unless you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth, you have to do it yourself, and a lot of things don't get done because there isn't the resources. And you try and ask any foundation now, look, I want to go and listen to these ringing rocks somewhere. I want to study this and that sound at a certain place. They'd have no time for it. It's not dramatic enough, they don't think. It is, if you're there, and if you're recording it. But so it's really inching along. I would say archaeoacoustics is where archaeoastronomy was about 15 or 20 years ago. So it's still a nascent subject area, but at least it's recognized as a component to archaeological research and anthropological research as well. So it's ongoing. We're understanding better how to do things. We recently did a study. It was artists and technicians and archaeologists working together on one site on Anglesey of our Clodiani Gauras, a Neolithic chambered monument. And I did sound study there on that. And other people did visual studies and so on and so forth. And we had an exhibition finished in December last year. And and there's a recording of report of that in Time and Mind. It happens more often now than it was. My research is very much on ringing rocks now. Because some of the sound that was picked up in the chambers, people say, oh, no, that was just accidental. Oh, no, that's not real. You're just reading into it. So there's all these carping old critics. But with the ringing rocks, there can't be any debate. They are there. They ring. They're musical. They have marks on them where they were used in the remote antiquity. And so it's a great study area. And as I've gone into it cross-culturally, as I say, we found it out how it was used in ancient China, ancient India, throughout Africa, in the Americas and so on. So that's really where my focus on sound is at the moment.
Well, just one final point. Terence McKenna spoke of the archaic revival. As people, slowly at first, but with kind of gathering energy, become dissatisfied with many aspects of the modern world, because, you know, industrial civilization promised so much and it seems to be coming unstuck in many ways at the minute. As that's happening, because I'm paying close attention to this, I notice more and more people are interested in how we lived before. And, you know, there's no going back. We can only go forward, but I think there is a lot we can learn. And some of the things we've been talking about, I've noticed people interested in all sorts of things that can actually improve their lifestyle when the things that they have been kind of taught or trained to work and strive for aren't really delivering you know, the quality of life that they want. So it's a general point, but it'll be interesting to see as the next few decades unfold how much maybe our societies will change in response to some of the, you know, the modern crises that we've brought on ourselves.
Oh, yes. It'll certainly be very interesting. And it's a bit daunting, really, to look at the future of the way we're going. We will have to change in some ways. To put in a little plug for myself here, I do workshops where I show people how they can lock into sound and light and time in a different way to the cultural world around them in their own homes. And there are things you can do that can give you that respite from the pressures of the world and its noise and its pollution and so on. And we've developed these techniques to help people very simply to restore their souls and calm their minds and lock into greater cycles of time than the ticking digital clock that we're subject to now.
Well, quite. Today, Paul, we've been talking, just final reminder, Stone Age Soundtracks, the Acoustic Archaeology of Ancient Sites. That seems to be out of print, but it's certainly still available on Amazon and other such sites. Copies are out there.
If it is, actually, because Amazon doesn't update that often. It's available through my website, for sure. That's the certain place for it.
Okay, we'll give people your website, or websites, anything you'd like to share about those forthcoming projects, workshops, just anything you want to put out there.
So you can get the book. We still have some copies left, and because it went through a number of editions. My website is www.pauldevereaux.co.uk, and you can still get it even signed from there. I've given you the Royal College website where our landscape perception research is lodged. That's not quite up to date. We've done more work that's yet to be put up on the site, constantly ongoing. You can see my books on Amazon, for example. I've got a page, an author's page there. And you can generally keep in touch. You can email me at paul@pauldevereaux.co.uk and through my website. Anyway, one other thing I should say, because this is available, is the book Sacred Geography that came out in 2010, and that you can still get on Amazon or through my website. And that has a summary of the visual and sonic work, and it's very up-to-date throughout the world. The work that's going on with that. It's very visual and it's a handsome little book. And it's a great summary of the sort of things we've been talking about. And that's probably the most accessible book at the moment.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us today on LegaliseFreedom.com.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegaliseFreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegaliseFreedom.com.